We now have Paul Keating from Renova in Spain. We've invited Paul to present today because Paul submitted comments to on the booklets produced by ICANN. He produced comments on the IRT's report. Paul also has produced a solution as well. So we felt it was a good idea to have Paul up here. And another reason is that I suspect, and none of us has seen Paul's slides, I suspect Paul is going to actually present something from an alternative view, because we've been quite heavy from the point of view of trademark protection today, so it's good to hear from Paul on the other side of the bench. And Paul, you said 15 minutes at most?
Oh, somewhere between that and an hour and a half.
No. We'll be turning you off.
No, clearly. No, I promise you no more than 10 minutes. And first, Nick, thank you very much for inviting me up here. And thanks for to the IRT for a lot of work on a very difficult task, I'm sure. One of the, a little bit of introduction. I've been a lawyer since 1983, which makes me one of the old guard. I actually worked in this industry before there were computers and before there was an internet. And now I practice exclusively in the internet space, representing domain registrars as well as registrants. And that consists of pretty much exclusively our practice that keeps three attorneys and some staff busy in Barcelona, much to my surprise. So the second point is I'm not anti-trademark, right? I am clearly on the other side of the aisle of many of my respected colleagues here, but I'm not anti-trademark. What I want to present here is a kind of a plea. It takes off a little bit on Nick's first comment, which was what we're here is to seek agreement on principles. So I see this as a balancing mechanism and a balancing process. And unfortunately, what I've heard so far is not very well balanced. It presumes, for example, that they're all great trademark claimants and all bad registrants. In fact, there are very many good trademark holders who are very diligent in what types of complaints they do bring about. And there are some very bad registrants, and I'm constantly amazed every day when I read UDRP decisions. Why did anybody have to waste their time on this case? But that being said, there are very many bad trademark holders who clearly seek to abuse the system. We just finished one, a UDRP, in which we were faced with 2,600 pages of complaint. 900-page complaint followed by the balance in a supplemental filing for which we had 5 days to respond. It weighed 27 pounds, I believe. The panel found that it was harassing but didn't even give us a reverse domain name hijacking decision because the claimant had in fact obtained a trademark. The trademark was cheap auto insurance used to sell insurance for vehicles, granted by the United States Patent and Trademarks Office. The domain name was cheapautoinsurance.com, used to sell insurance products. So there are cases in which we have to balance the process so that my clients and others like my clients, who are respectable domainers, are not faced with spending $10,000 or more to defend a UDRP of this nature. Okay, so what I'd like to do is, if we could go to the first slide, this is my summary of the UDRP, written very quickly. Some of the major problems. There's a lack of judicial oversight. In many jurisdictions in the world, one would be surprised to know that a losing respondent cannot even file a claim to have a court review the UDRP decision in one of the mutual jurisdictions in which they're obligated to do so, simply because the law does not have a process by which such a respondent may do so. And some of the countries would surprise you. They include, for example, Australia. You cannot, as a losing respondent, bring a claim to contest a UDRP decision unless you happen to have a trademark in Australia that covers that exact name. There's a failure overall to apply traditional trademark laws. Now, we've spoken a lot, and the IRT speaks a lot, about these common principles of law, trademark laws, international policy. Trademark law is not sitting up and measuring text versus text and saying that's identical and that's confusingly similar without looking at the content and the context in which the trademark exists and in which the offending term is being used. There's a failure to abide by the original intents that were expressed. There's an unbalanced system in many respects. It is largely unmanaged by ICANN. And the complaints, contrary to some of the information that we have seen, including today with the example from the speaker from WIPO about Tamil flu and how registrants jump in to register domain names based on headlines, all the cases were from 2005 and 2006 on your report. The incident happened yesterday. So yes, domainers do jump in and take advantage of headlines. And yes, there are cases of abuse, clear cases of abuse. But I think if you stood back and you measured the number of claims today based on the number of registered domain names, you'd find a precipitative decrease in the actual number of UDRP cases when compared to the number of registrations. And one thing that doesn't get included is, yes, many cases default, but many cases are defended. And in many cases, the cost of defense is much higher than the cost of actually filing the complaint. So part of the balance. This was the intended purpose, one of the guidelines, in creating the UDRP to begin with. Not intended to provide the holders of intellectual property rights more protection in cyberspace than in the real world. That's fine. The problem is it's not being applied that way. Trademarks are limited by jurisdiction and classification of goods. So the context of use becomes important. And this is not surprising. There's a quotation from the U.S. Supreme Court dated 1924, which remains current law. It gives only the right to prohibit you the trade prohibit use insofar as it protects the holder of the mark against someone who's trying to sell the same products claiming that they're his. The WIPO final report contains, and documents since this time, contain repeated instances of language where the intent is not to expand upon the rights of trademark holders. But we have some basic problems in the UDRP as it's applied, and my concern is, in the context of the URS, we're going to have the same problems. We have no importation of local laws into the UDRP decisionary process. Matter of fact, there are cases out there that say the concepts of legitimacy and bad faith are autonomous concepts to be interpreted consistently under the policy. Under what law? I have no idea. But the question arises, why not import concepts, local concepts of law? We have, in fact, imported those same concepts when we found the claimant having trademark rights. We resorted to the actual local law in order to find those rights, but we're not resorting to the local law of the applicable jurisdictions to look at the rights of the respondent. So we've seen some examples of clear-cut abuse of registrants. I don't defend them, okay? But here are some cases of clear-cut abuse, in my opinion, of the UDRP process. A complainant can win even when the trademark did not exist when the domain name was registered. If we go back to the original intent of the UDRP, and as I'm hearing it, the URS, it's only for clear-cut cases of cybersquatting, where someone registered a domain name with the intention of marketing, of benefiting from the other person's trademark. So I don't see how you could mix those two principles with the decision, with the statement in the overview, the panel overview stated at WIPO. Common law trademarks can exist even though your evidence of use is use in a country that doesn't recognize common law trademarks. This is another instance. Complainants can claim a trademark right even when the term has been expressly disclaimed in the trademark application or registration in which they're actually asserting the claim. Airborne systems, well, even worse, it was a figurative element in which the term was disclaimed. Drugstore has been held to be a valid trademark. The burden to avoid conflict with established rights, even if less than universally established, should rest upon the registrant. And this was a dissent, but this is an opinion of a panelist. You know, I've had many instances in which we're presenting defenses, and there are many instances in which the panels are reaching conclusions that, in my personal opinion, are directly contrary, and in they contradict the actual intent that was expressed in the documentation that created the process. So this becomes my overwhelming concern when I review more information and more documents that profess to apply neutral standards in a balanced manner to decide a clear-cut, dispute about trademarks. So my overall problems with the URS is that it's not very rapid. We have to wait until after an examiner who's paid $100 gives a considered opinion. They've got a poor notification system. I really would like to have facts be included in there, and I'd also like to insist that any exhibits be transmitted electronically. There are too many domains and too many potential parties for one to respond. There's no, although I appreciate the concept that a trademark has to have been registered in a jurisdiction in which there is a substantive review process, we have a substantive review process in the United States, but you can also submit a declaration under Section 2F and claim acquired distinctiveness, which is viewed only on an ex parte basis and only on a prima facie case basis. So hence you get registered trademarks for the likes of cheap auto insurance, used to sell insurance. I doubt those are the types of trademarks that the panel had in mind, that the IRT had in mind, but those are the trademarks that nevertheless can fulfill the rules. We have figurative marks issues in which you have a figurative element for the word cars and you use it to sell automobiles. It would never have been granted trademark rights for the text version, the word basis, under which it was really going to be used. Notwithstanding that, in a UDRP context, and one would presume in the URS, I could claim as the owner of the figurative mark all rights to the word cars and go after and obtain the domain name or suspend the domain name from of a registrant who's using it in PPC to sell automobiles. We have a new confusing burden of proof with no absolute rules for the panelist. We're injecting a very well-developed U.S. standard of proof. It's somewhat of a mixture between a summary judgment ruling and a 12B ruling. And we're imposing that on the rest of the world. And I don't think that the rest of the world and the panelists that come from the rest of the world will be able to appreciate that standard. Everybody believes that their own decisions are certainly based upon clear and convincing evidence. Otherwise, I wouldn't have made the decision. We've got no concept of legitimate interest. It's all but forgotten in the explanatory comments. Bad faith is all-inclusive. But if we're dealing with an all-inclusive concept of bad faith in a system that's intended to be clear-cut, they seem to be in conflict with one another. The whole concept of suspension makes my job all the more worse, all the more difficult. My clients may register bad names. Their systems are very large. They're very macro-scaled for hundreds of thousands of domain names. We like opportunities to get rid of them as soon as possible. We have our own systems, but they're not perfect for filtering these things out. What we don't want to do is to come across the same domain name again and again and again. We believe that trademark holders, as one of their obligations to police their marks, should actually keep these names. And if you understand the whole concept that drives the domain registration industry for the large volume user of the registrant, they are only going to register and keep domain names that actually have traffic. The people who, if you believe the complainant's argument, the people who are coming to that domain name, typing it into the browser, are people interested in the trademark holder. So one would ask yourself, if I'm going to go get a domain name, I'm going to file a complaint against a domain name, why wouldn't I want to keep the domain name and point it to my normal website and therefore obtain that customer? Verizon's very good at this. Verizon claims publicly to have recovered 9 million new users, new customers, based upon the domain names that they have recovered through the dispute processes. I don't understand in that context the suspension idea. The whole concept of abusive complaints is far too tolerant. We see it in the URS, we see it in the other dispute mechanisms where there's this concept of a meritless case. I don't know. I've never obtained a reverse domain name hijacking decision in my career. I've tried. I think there have been very clear-cut cases. The one of cheap auto insurance is a good example. Another example is NM Classifieds, very inexpensive domain name. Wasn't making very much money for the customer, but my customer just didn't agree with the concept. The complainant had filed a claim on the basis of a common law mark. He then had his claim rejected by NAF for amendment. In the process, he approached me through my client and wanted to buy the domain name. So we entered into a bill of sale. He signed it, stating a price, and my client signed it. And then he had a change of heart. He didn't want to pay the price that he had agreed to pay. And so he proceeded to amend the complaint at NAF and file and process through the UDRP. Now my client is spending $4,000, $5,000 to mount a defense to this claim. And the panelist recognizes that there's been a contract, but doesn't find a reverse domain name hijacking case because he didn't find that this was bad faith on the part of the complainant. So, I mean, if we have established rules that say if you have a if you have a trademark registration, there is, in essence, no way you're going to be found to have acted in bad faith. I don't see how the panelists are now going to turn around and say, oh, my goodness, this is now without merit. Because you have to have a trademark, a registered trademark, in order to have gotten to square one. So I don't even see how you're ever going to have a meritless case. And I don't like the concept of the free do-over. If you're going to choose, if URS comes about and you're going to choose that as a process, then that's your process. You waive your right to do the UDRP. Because otherwise, for my clients, I'm stuck defending this twice. And the second go-around, I've given you all of my defense. Okay? So you've gotten a free, you know, new trial. Motion for new trial, automatically granted. And I don't think that's basically fair. Because it doesn't address, really, those situations in which the IRT is raising the bar on these things, saying that these are for serial cyber squatters who have no clear interest in this domain name other than to trade on my trademark or my client's trademark. Well, if that's so clear-cut, then stand by what your position is. Waive your client's right to proceed on the UDRP and lower the bar for yourself. Raise the bar, rather. So going on, as Nick had indicated, I filed my own comments and included my suggestion. Was a rather wordy comment filed in ICANN. I've tried to distill it down. And the principle is, if you're going to be a critic, you need to supply a solution. You can't just criticize something, because that's just cheap, and everybody can do that. So here's my suggestion. I don't know whether this is a good suggestion or a bad suggestion. My clients like it. I don't speak on behalf of them, but I do know that they like it. But the process is to essentially, we're not going to have the idea is we don't have a separate system. We don't have a separate set of panelists who are trying to understand a new separate set of rules and a new standard of burden of proof, et cetera. We just simply put in a very, very small amendment into the existing UDRP process. And I liked, actually, I don't know if this is the best solution, because the solution I heard from WIPO is a very good solution. It's one that I've been suggesting to people at WIPO and suggesting to people at NAF for many, many years, which is to have an opt-in default. I don't want to defend a name. I default, turn the name over instantly. I also like the idea of turning off the domain name on the default. So in this concept, I've actually gone a little bit further. I've imposed an obligation on the respondent, because I agree, we should weed out the default cases. Right? Those should be gone. They're a waste of everybody's time. So in day 14, the respondent, having received notification by email with all exhibits, and by fax with all exhibits, has to make an election. They elect to defend the dispute. So anybody can file that election, so we have to put a price on it. Now, because most of these domain names are in PPC land, and most of them are going to default, if you think about it and you understand how PPC works, most of the defaults occur because the registrant is not making very much money off this domain name, but they're making more than the registration fees, or possibly even not. But they're not going to give it up today, because they might as well just eke out whatever more 20 cents or 30 cents that they're going to earn on it through the entire UDRP process. So in other words, the web page stays alive. And it's really interesting that this is now a problem that is raised by the trademark holders. Because I'll tell you, when I first started into this business, my first dispute was in 1997, we turned off the domain name as a respondent. We did it for the first 5 times. And in each of those 5 times, it was cited as evidence of bad faith by the panelists to have done so. So we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't, almost. So I'm fine with turning it off. I'm fine with having the registrant step up and pay a fee, because that will eliminate those that would otherwise default. So you pay a small fee, $50, $100, whatever. It's a very small fee for the type of domain names that I defend. If you file the fee and you elect to defend, then the domain name stays up and alive, and the UDRP process continues its normal, merry way. If you have your response due in basically 6 more days. If the respondent is paid a fee, in most of my cases we elect a 3-member panel, which means that my clients are paying, in addition to my fees, another $1,500 on top of this in order to defend it. So then we get a credit for what we paid. If we elect to surrender the name, then the UDRP process halts. There's no point in going further. The domain name is transferred. I know that there's a difference in policy between WIPO and NAF. WIPO will actually recredit or credit back the claimant, 90% approximately, 80 or 90%? Essentially the panel portion of the fees that they've paid, as long as the panel has not been appointed. And since this occurs at the well before a default stage, there's no reason why those fees shouldn't go back to the complainant. If they do nothing, then the domain name is immediately suspended and the UDRP process returns to its normal course, with the exception that the web page no longer resolves. We have certain other issues to deal with for mail servers and things like that, but the web page could go to just simply a controlled blank white web page. This does involve an amendment to the UDRP process, and in responding to me and inviting me here, Nick stated in his email that the IRT had considered making changes, but didn't think that anybody really wanted to. I'll tell you on behalf of my clients and fellow practitioners, there's a clear desire to modify the UDRP, perhaps not in the way that you perhaps envision from the trademark holder's side. But again, we're more than happy to talk about a balanced approach to this, one that does not increase the rights of trademark holders and which actually applies the language that we've all agreed to in creating the process in the beginning. And there are just two other ones that I would love to see put into the new revised UDRP. Now, because we're talking about a remedy that applies only to new GTLDs, we're not amending a UDRP. We're simply adding this into the process for the dispute mechanism applicable to new TLDs. So we're not touching, we're not opening Pandora's box, so to speak. So we do have a real opportunity here to test it, see if it works. And if it works and we can all reach agreement, we see no reason why applying a more balanced approach through amendment of the UDRP to the .com, .net, .info, et cetera world. And I think that's where everybody wants to get to.
Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.